As Christians, we believe some pretty incredible things. We believe that God entered time and space, lived among us. We could watch him, listen to him, ask him questions. The point being that God is knowable. You can actually know God. We believe that this God who came to earth, who lived among us, turned out to be the Lamb of God. He was killed, and it was either him or us. And we come out of that saying, this God that is so distant and so vast actually loves us. We believe that Christ rose from the dead, that one day he got out of that tomb, walked out of there. You know, they rolled away the stones so that people could see that the place was empty. And what that comes out for us as meaning is that all this stuff that Jesus went around saying about eternal life is true. It's actually going to happen. We believe that Jesus ascended and returned to the Father, and that he is in the, what we call the inner sanctuary, or, you know, he's there interceding for us, which means that our eternal position with God is already guaranteed. It's in the bag. Now, any one of those ideas by itself is just it's a traffic stopper. I mean, there's no way that life can be the same once we accept those things. And we have these profound truths that we say are the foundation of our lives. But then there's everyday life. And we have kids, and they have to eat. And they have to wear clothes, and so we go to work. And we have to deal with the, you know, just the pressures of work, of business. You have to deal with things like, you know, just the risks of business, the time crunch, just the responsibility that you have to assume. You have to be there when you have to be there. Problems of cash flow and all of that. And then just the fact that business is getting, we've changed the rules on business. And, you know, everything is accelerated. And, you know, we've collapsed the information flow, the time frame for that, down to zero. And so we deal with that. And we deal with the fact that just the rules for commerce, for politics and everything else have changed. The old rules don't work anymore. And here we are, kind of fighting to survive in the everyday world. And then over here we have these truths that I just mentioned. And somehow or other, it seems to be an irresolvable dichotomy between those two things. And we say, okay, how do I get these two things to match? And I think for most people, mentally, there is almost no connection. For most Christians, there is almost no connection between what we believe and then just the things that we have to deal with in our everyday lives. The thing that we need to realize is that we are up against a set of forces that probably do not recognize, that we're unaware of. Here in our notes, how do we keep our bearings and live purposefully in the midst of the revolution that is changing the rules of everything from global politics to commerce to how we live everyday life? In this borderless world, how do we serve God and do our business, compete, and still care for people, raise a family, and stay on the cutting edge professionally? That's some of the issues that Alan mentioned last night. What's happening? Well, we're being hit by a storm that has been brewing for about 500 years and is radically changing the landscape of our society. Never in human history has there been an upheaval of the magnitude we're experiencing right now. And we need to understand what's going on, because we could get blown away by the storm. If we understand it, we can learn to make use of the storm. This storm began with the Renaissance, a period of about 30 years, 1490 to 1520. Amazing period of time where several just phenomenal people converged. Michelangelo, who with his art made a statement that there is a new man. And we'll be talking about that later. Leonardo da Vinci, who both an artist and a scientist, who conjectured up possible inventions. He even thought that man could fly. Can you imagine that? And made some drawings accordingly. There's Christopher Columbus, who opened the way for a new world. There's Copernicus, who advanced a new cosmology. There's Martin Luther, who was one of many who broke up the monolith of the Catholic Church. Together with these men, there were a series of inventions that just sort of contributed to a real change, a real turnaround as they broke out of the Middle Ages. Gunpowder. You know, I guess that's the way that you invent gunpowder, is you have it blow up on you a few times. And that, of course, the gunpowder was one of the things that was essential to the breaking up of the old feudal system. The compass. Can you imagine? Until they had the compass and the sextant, why, they didn't, in traveling in the ocean, they didn't dare get out of sight of land, because how'd they know how to get back? And so, you know, there's the sextant. And then the mechanical clock. Here's a guy, you know, working with the non-mechanical clock. Here's one of the earliest mechanical clocks, not exactly a wristwatch. Another mechanical clock, neither, that's not a wristwatch either. But that profoundly changed our society from being oriented. You know, time was determined pretty much, measured by, you know, where the sun was and when it set and so on. So we were tied to the sun. Now we're tied to the wristwatch. I don't know whether that was a good invention or not. But then the printing press, here's Gutenberg, and the here's a press. And notice over here on the right, this demonic-like creature, another several in the room. The printing press was seen by the theologians as being demonic, because, boy, how are we going to control the knowledge of people if everybody has access to things that are written? And so, you know, that was met with opposition. So the first thing that came out was a Bible, a Gutenberg Bible here. And, of course, the printing press, back up here, the printing press was one of the most substantial innovations, in the sense that the idea of reading without even, you know, reading to yourself was new. That somebody could sit and read and have thoughts go on in his mind. That was something that came along after the printing press, and reading became more popular. And of course, ideas could develop, and you could communicate your ideas to people. It saved Martin Luther's bacon. He nailed the 95 Theses on the Gutenberg door, and had it been, you know, a printing press, you know, Martin Luther would never have been heard from again. They would have burned him at the stake, and it would have been just one more little a flurry in the German church, in German Catholic Church. But because that thesis that was nailed to the door found its way to England by the hundreds and thousands, all of a sudden Martin Luther was too big to kill. And so we find that was one of the things that really changed history. And so the big idea of the Renaissance is the affirmation that man can do it. I would say it was the birth of humanism, faith in man himself. And you see, this is, of course, the Sistine Chapel. I mean, look at the muscles on Adam, and, you know, look at the muscles on God. I mean, they belong on a muscle magazine. I mean, you never see people like that except in muscle magazines. But just the exquisite beauty of Michelangelo's work, his paintings. Just the attention to the human form. And his statement was, I have to apologize for this, the guy that shot these slides just thought he had an attack of decency, and so he put this he put this little leaf in a strategic position in the Statue of David. And you know, I think it loses something that way. But there it is. But I mean, just look at the perfection of the physique. And that was the message of the Renaissance, is that man is his own master. Man can do it. And so Leonardo da Vinci's design, you've probably seen it. A lot of people use it for a logo or something like that. And it's just a statement to the perfect man. And that, of course, was the spirit of the Renaissance. Okay. Turn the page. The Age of Reason was the result of the Renaissance produced the Age of Reason. They had the tools, they had the mindset for the Age of Reason to really get off and running. period from 1600 up to the late 1700s. And the Age of Reason, or the Enlightenment, gave birth to two revolutions. The first one was the Scientific Revolution. Some of the big ideas that launched the Scientific Revolution, this is Copernicus, and he theorized that the Earth actually moves. And so he introduced a new cosmology. Isaac Newton, this is Copernicus' design of the universe, the Earth revolving around the sun and the other planets and so on. Isaac Newton maintained that the Earth and the planets are controlled by gravity, introduced a modern calculus. Francis Bacon, this was Isaac Newton's means of discovering that the Earth is controlled by gravity. He dropped his apple, not that one, but an apple. Then Francis Bacon maintained that knowledge comes from observing. And by measuring the material world, he articulated the scientific method. Now, all of these early scientists were devout Christians. Their basic assumption was that God created an orderly universe that can be studied, that it doesn't, jump around and the rules don't change from time to time. But so he has laws of nature that can be understood by observation. And so they went into science as a spiritual act of, we're going to know more about God because science is going to is his work and we're going to be able to observe it. Now, the next part of the Age of Reason, the other revolution, was a philosophical revolution. Theologians and scientists soon came into conflict. Copernicus was the first to run into trouble because with his theory of a sun-centered universe. The problem with that is that this theory was theologically incorrect. After all, Psalm 93:1 says the world is firmly established, it cannot be moved. How much more proof do you need than that? Well, both the Catholic Church and the Reformers, Martin Luther and John Calvin, were just aghast at what Copernicus was saying. And the Inquisition was going on, and so Copernicus, not exactly being a hero, decided that he'd kind of keep things to himself, and so he managed to live happily ever after. But then Galileo came along, and he created a telescope, made a telescope, and he could demonstrate that the Earth moved around the sun. And so I saw a play years ago in Brazil called Galileo Galileo. And I don't know how historically correct it was, but it was a great play because Galileo had his telescope all set up and trained on a planet. And so here he is. He's in his observatory there, and he's got his telescope trained on the planet. And then he calls the bishops in, and he says, okay, now I want you to look through this telescope, and you will, and they say, well, why? Well, you'll see a planet there. Well, why do we want to see a planet through your telescope? Well, you'll see that it moves. And they says, no, we don't need to look through your telescope. We know that the planets don't move because the Bible says so, that the Earth will not be moved. And so he never did get them to look through that telescope. And so they run him through the Inquisition, with the danger of the guillotine. And so they got him to recant. He wasn't a hero either. And so he said, no, it doesn't move. And in the play, under his breath, the last scene is, but it does move. And so there he is. And he spent the rest of his life under house arrest, because even though he did recant and denied that it did move. Well, the problem with this, and the reason I'm going into this, is that science and religion soon found themselves in real conflict. And the scientist says, we got to get these guys out of the room. And we can't think with these guys, throwing verses at us all the time. And so there was a rupture between science and religion. And scientists began to preach a new scientific civilization based on unbiased analysis of data. And they believed that human reason would bring us a safer, more civilized world. We've sure proven that isn't true. Science became our new faith, but science and reason soon were in tension, just as religion and science had been. Some of the early men of the Enlightenment, like Rousseau, said, well, We can't weigh and measure everything. In fact, there are dimensions of the human experience that defy weighing and measuring and so on. But that was really the issue. The scientific side of things says the things that we know are the things that we can weigh and measure. And how can you weigh and measure God? You can't. So how do you know he exists? And so there was a rupture. And so then what happened was that science took over and became the guardian of truth. Where the church was once the guardian of truth, now science is the guardian of truth. But that didn't last long, because reason came along and said, well, the more you study science, the more you find out that we don't know everything. And so we have some illustrations of that. Copernicus, again, with his theory of the Earth not being the center of the universe. What that did, of course, to the theologians and to the scientists was to make them realize that, well, you know, maybe this planet isn't, or think, maybe this planet isn't as special as we really thought it was. Later on, Charles Darwin came along with his theory of evolution, and he said, man, his message was, man is maybe not the center of God's creation. He's just one more beast, one more animal. And so the centrality of man was really challenged. And then Freud came along, and one of his foundational thesis is that even our best, most well-reasoned arguments are just a cover-up for you know, what he called the bestial primal instincts, the irrational instincts. And you see that all the time. You know, a scientist will have just an array of logical stuff, and you know that right behind it is, you know, the subjectivity, you know, his reaction against his mother or something else just kind of on his sleeve. And you see the same thing, you know, with people in their theology or whatever. And so what happens is that we've come to the conclusion that philosophically we're forced into the conclusion that the human mind cannot be relied upon as an accurate judge of reality. Truth is relative. And so what happens is that truth has lost its ability to affect everyday life. And that's really what post-modern modernity is, what some people call our day now. It's a rejection of both biblical religion and the work of the Enlightenment. And they say neither one of those will help us put together a chart for life. They say the term is meta-story. There is no meta-story. There is no story that puts the whole thing together and makes it comprehensible for us. And so we've given up on that. Now, meanwhile, the Industrial Revolution is cranking up. And it's a product of the scientific work that has been done. And in the middle of the 19th century, you had the innovation of, you know, the reaper, the steam engine, the tractor, the steel plow, and those things revolutionized farming. But manufacturing soon replaced farming as the real engine of our economy. And out of the manufacturing came, cities, the emergence of a whole other way of life, the urbanization. And the formula was simple. If you have some money, capital, and if you have access to raw materials, and if you have human resource, labor, you're going to make money. That equals wealth. And so that was the basis of the Industrial Revolution, and the idea of factories, where, just another shot of urbanization, the idea of factories, like Henry Ford, I think, was the first to come along with the idea of interchangeable parts. And so you could have an assembly line, and if all parts were the same for all cars, rather than each piece having to be made independently, you could make an awful lot of cars in a hurry. And, you know, if you had just the same color paint. So you can have any color car you want as long as it's black, was what Henry Ford said. And so This had a profound impact on our society. As people urbanized, we had the birth of the nuclear family. You had a new kind of family. You had a new kind of wealth. You didn't have to have land to become wealthy. You didn't have to be an aristocrat to be wealthy. This was something that just, this was a new way to make money. There was also a new kind of poverty, just a deadly poverty, because as long as you have a piece of land, you can eat. But if you find yourself without money in a city, then you're in really serious trouble. And so, but what happened was that the Industrial Revolution provided a capacity, enhanced our capacity just to make things. And we outproduced our ability to buy. And that's what produced the Great Depression. Factories and warehouses were stuffed with inventories and there were no buyers. And so industry and government teamed up to get the economy moving, you know, the New Deal and WPA and those systems back there to create jobs, and the government set out to create the jobs, and industry set out to create the consumer. And in the notes I have a quote by Charles Kettering of General Motors. The key to economic prosperity is the organized creation of dissatisfaction. Now think about this. Industry embarked on a deliberate crusade to convert the American from the traditional virtues of Yankee frugality and frontier self-sacrifice to consumerism or self-gratification. This is a quotation from a book by Jeremy Rifkin, The End of Work. The mass consumption phenomena did not occur spontaneously, nor was it the inevitable byproduct of an insatiable human nature. Quite the contrary. Economists at the turn of the century noted that most working people were content to just earn enough income to provide for their basic needs and a few luxuries, after which they preferred increased leisure time over additional work and work hours and extra income. Now, the problem with that is, how are you going to make any money if you don't have people working all the time? If they would rather spend time with their families than to go on and work and produce more goods, then that's going to be a restriction on the economy. And so the fact that people preferred to trade additional hours of work for additional hours of leisure time became a critical concern and a bane to businessmen whose inventories of goods were quickly piling up on factory floors and in warehouses across the nation. So, enter marketing. See, marketing was born to transform wants into needs. That's the basic idea of marketing. And so, we had the birth of fashion, vogue, chic, where, you know, people had to dress in a certain way to be acceptable, being modern, being versus being old-fashioned. I remember when I was a little boy, my mother made a shirt for me one time. And I was too embarrassed to wear it because it was handmade. You know, now you'd pay double for a handmade shirt. But back there, you know, that was the spirit. If it's handmade, or if it's not just exactly so, then you're old-fashioned, you're not modern. Brand names came in. Planned obsolescence, where, you know, this year's car is great, but a few years from now, they call it long in tooth, and you need to change it. It's a perfectly good car, but it's long in tooth, and so we need to replace it. And so, you know, the brand names, your status is determined by, you know, the brand on your garments or on your watch, and even in produce. My dad had a grocery store down in St. James, Minnesota, when I was a little kid, and it was one of those stores, you know, before the supermarkets, but it did a supermarket-type business. He had 10 employees that did nothing but run around the store and fill grocery lists that people would hand them. And so instead of people taking a cart and going through the store, the clerks would go do that. And there were barrels of pickles, barrels of hams, barrels of flour, wheat, cornmeal, molasses, all kinds of things came in the bulk. And then there were a few brand names at that time. Baker's Chocolate was the first one. And so what they do is they'd each one take out of that same barrel and put their label on it and claim that it's best. And so you had this kind of competition. But the result of all of this, as we became status conscious, the subtle change that began to take place in our society that has profound effect on every one of us in this room is that status was gained not by what a person knew or what the person could do or the ability to produce things, but status was simply the ability to purchase things. And so if you could buy it, you were somebody. And so the Americans set off in this insatiable race in pursuit of things. Competition with your neighbors. We've got some neighbors who, for the life of me, I can't understand, but they look at somebody buying a car in the neighborhood, and next thing you know, they've done the same thing. And they're not happy until they've done that. We all know people, maybe some of us are that kind of people. And, of course, this put pressure on us as well, because there's a social requirement to become the owner of things. And so this put a tremendous pressure on us, and we all live with that pressure today. And if you could sift that, just that one element out of your life and set that aside and get your family to do the same thing, you would be relieved of most of the pressure that you're living with. Well, now, but we haven't seen anything yet in terms of pressure. The technological knowledge revolution, we're on page 4 now, amazing. In about 1955 is the year that marked the emergence of the commercial jet. That's not a 1955 model, but it allowed global travel, gave us access to the world in a new way, the computer, the accessibility of information. Birth control gave new freedom, a new era for women. Television, a new era for mass communication, and the world all of a sudden began to see the same things, the same images, hear the same messages, and so that began to bring about just a tremendous change in the way we lived and the way we did things. And then since 1985, now that was the year that we moved from Brazil to the U.S. And I remember asking my next-door neighbor what a fax machine was, because I'd never heard of a fax machine. And he patiently explained to me what a fax machine was. Well, it was new then. And, since then, it's only 12 years ago, you have the fax machine, you have the satellites, that carry the communication. That's all since 1985. You have the personal computer, and you have the email. The cell phone, yes. And you think about what these innovations have done to us. It's collapsed the communication time down to zero. There's no limit to how much information you can pass to a limitless number of people around the world in an instant. So time is no longer a factor, nor is distance a factor for a lot of things. A lot of things. But what that has done to you as a person. I remember, putting a letter in the mail and thinking, it'll be turnaround, that's about 5 days, and so I have time to think about that and get on with other things and so on. Well, now, you send a fax, or you receive a fax, and it comes and it's still warm, and the phone rings. And somebody says, "Did you get my fax?" "Yeah, I just did." "Well, how come you haven't answered it?" And so, with just the ante pumped up. I mean, just, time. And the thing you can be sure of is that, the more we use these time-saving devices, the less time we have. In fact, if you want to be sure that you're going flat out all the time, just, you know, buy the toys. And you are going to be one very busy person. And so you think, well, you know, maybe I ought to just bail out of that. But, you know, then there are some ominous things on the horizon, you know, like, you know, if you can't stay in the traffic, you know, get off. Well, if you get off, you don't compete anymore. We don't have the choice of not, you know, getting in the race. And the thing that nudges us along, I have in the notes here a few ominous terms: buyouts, takeovers, reengineering, downsizing, retraining, early retirement. You know, all of those are kind of scary. Now, what's happened is the effects of this storm, combining the changes in technology with the changes in just our philosophy, our way of thinking, is that we have the way that we do things, just get things done, has been profoundly altered. But then the way we think has also been profoundly altered. So turn the page over to page 5. We've worked our way through three different worldviews that are shown in this design. The original one was a religious worldview that said, we theologians will just tell you what to believe. But, you know, that was just a stranglehold on progress. And, you know, the world was run by dogmas. And if you didn't agree with a particular dogma, you'd be burned at the stake. And so, you know, that wasn't exactly the good old days. So science came along and says, well, we can create an orderly world that can be understood through observation. And so give us some space. And so the space it took was just, it was too much. Where they says, we will guide you into all truth. And so we went from a religious worldview to a humanistic worldview. But then reason came along and said, science doesn't tell us everything. There are whole hunks of things that science can't teach us. And so we have moved to what I call the pagan worldview. Paganism, belief in many gods. India, Hinduism, 60 million gods, some good, some bad. Some you take care of and some you stay away from. And, you know, in America, we've taken on a lot with the New Age. I mean, that's basically, it's Hinduism. And so what's happened is that there is a blur between God and creation. We're really not sure which is which anymore. And so the way the adulation we give to our animals, our pets, and so on, I think is an expression of that, the way we treat some aspects of nature. Toynbee wrote a book, Mankind and Mother Earth. Mother Earth is the goddess. And so we have kind of a messed up notion of the difference between God and his creation. Man and animals is another just confusion, where we can abort fetuses, but boy, if you kill a puppy, you're in trouble. The difference between man and women, not sure on that. Men are beginning to grope their way back to actually conclude that they are people again. And, in the midst of some resistance. And so a woman is confused as to what she is. Man is confused as to what he is. The idea of good and evil. And so what's happened is that where you have relativism, we really can't think anything at all. And anything is a possibility. We begin to play with truth. The virtual reality that television or the computer is bringing to us. We have virtual music now, where you digitize a musician, take his sound, the way he plays it, and you digitize it, and so you walk into some place, bar someplace, and so on. Here's this guy on this honky little keyboard, and it sounds like Wes Montgomery. Playing some dumb tune that he wouldn't be caught dead playing. But we've taken this great musician and we've digitized him, and now, you know, he's kind of public domain. If you've seen the commercial the Coors commercial, you know, two really bad guys walking in, and they're just helping themselves to the beer, and everybody's intimidated, and then all of a sudden their manner changes, and in walks John Wayne. And so John Wayne has a little conversation with them, and John Wayne has a Coors in his hand, and those guys buy for everybody in the bar. How many of you have seen that commercial? Yeah, some of you have. Or Fred Astaire dancing with the vacuum cleaner. Well, what the Astaire thing was done differently, but they morphed John Wayne, which means they digitized him. And theoretically, you could have John Wayne doing a movie with Fred Astaire and maybe Clark Gable and Whoopi Goldberg. And, you know, I don't know what the script would be, but, you know, technologically, we're able to do that. And so the line between truth and non-truth is just invisible. And then Jay Leno wrote a autobiography. And in his autobiography, he tells this story on himself. And he was in on a talk show, and, you know, this thing happened. Well, someone called his attention to the fact that that wasn't you, John, that was somebody else that had that happen to him on this talk show. And John says, well, yeah, I know. Well, then why is it in your autobiography? Well, it just makes my story better. And so, you know, whatever makes the story better, hey, that's true, that's good. And so we're doing that with history, and so we've erased the line between truth and untruth, to where it really doesn't matter. And so what happens, we come out of these things that I've described, the consumerism that has been pushed upon us, the idea that there is no truth, and we live by a set of lies. And they are very, very hard to identify. Here are a few lies we live by. Look out for number one. Achieve your full potential. Big is good. Bigger is better. The biggest business is the most successful business. The business that makes the most money is the most successful business. I will be happier when I get my new car or boat or facelift. It doesn't matter what another person believes. That's his or her business. I mean, those little slogans that we live by, those ideas that we live by, they're so subtle and they're so ingrained that we just unwittingly take them on board and live by them. Now, if you're looking at that list and you think, hey, what's wrong with that? Those look pretty good to me. You're in trouble, because all of these are lies. They're false. And the thing is that you know, we who follow Christ, we're not immune to these things. And what I find in my own life is that I've still got an awful lot of lies hanging around that I'm attached to. And the most disconcerting thing is that they're so hard to spot. I had a conversation with a guy not long ago where a difficult thing happened to him. And he said, I feel rejected. And he said, so I feel shame because I feel rejected. And so I feel that I'm a failure. Well, all of those feelings that he had were based on lies. I had a conversation with a gal that I'd known for a long time. And she always dressed like a man. You know, she'd come around and, you know, just baggy, floppy clothes and so on. And I asked her about it one time. And she told me about what she went through, the molestation that she suffered with her brother and her father and so on like that. And she said, you know, I feel that if a man looks at me and is attracted to me, that then I am causing him to lust. I'm causing him to sin. And so I don't want a man to look at me and consider me to be beautiful, because then I'm doing him a disservice. Well, we talked on, and I says, hey, why don't you write down the things that you believe about your sexuality? and she's a brilliant person. And the next day, she came with 2.5 pages of stuff. And I read it, and I handed it back to her, and I said, you know, all of them are lies. And her eyes popped. And I says, okay, now go through the Bible. She knows the Bible. And write what the Bible says about each one of those things. And she began to pick her way out of the lies that controlled her life. Much of the pressure that we feel as people who want to serve God in the middle of this world comes from lies that control our behavior, and it came courtesy of the ad men. Let me turn this off and go to the next point. We're on top of page 6, the tribalization of our society. And that's what I think is happening, is tribalization. And I'll explain what I mean by that. It takes 3 things to hold a society together. There's belief, there's behavior, there's belonging, and those 3 feed each other and create a society. For example, the U.S. was founded on free enterprise, which is another term for capitalism. And the basic assumption that the nation was founded on, as I understand it, is that capitalism or free enterprise would be the driving engine of the way we do things. In other words, if you can earn it, you can keep it. It's a basic idea. And so there's the incentive of earning. But capitalism by itself would just result in unbridled greed. So there were 2 modifiers. There was biblical religion, which would give us the conscience that we needed to do what is right. And it would bring morality into the equation. And republicanism is the other modifier, or the town hall, where we would get together in the town hall and we'd talk about what this merchant wants to do or what this developer wants to do and so on. And so we reach a consensus and we agree that, yes, we will go ahead with this because there is agreement. There is republicanism. Well, so we have a set of beliefs in, say, we believe in free enterprise. We believe that the scriptures will give us the guidance we need, the moral guidance, and we believe in one another to the point where we can proceed as a society. So the behavior works out of those beliefs. And so the behavior would be things that would be appropriate to that society. And so we develop patterns of behavior that are reflective of the belief. Now, people who behave according to the beliefs are the ones who belong. And so you have the maverick who just doesn't, who heads off. And that person remains an outsider to the society. And so those 3 things work together to create a sense of belonging. And even in your subcultures, the grunge culture, where the thing is to look as dirty as you can, and to look as just unkempt and smell as bad as you can, and so on. Well, that reflects a belief about just humanity, and it calls on for people to have a certain behavior. I mean, there is a dress code for the grunge culture that is really pretty stringent. You have to fit into the dress code. If you take a bath and if you put on a clean shirt, you are in trouble. And so you don't belong anymore. And so it's that pattern. Or, a motorcycle gang will have its own subculture. And so any group of people will operate out of a set of beliefs that calls for a certain kind of behavior and belonging. When you travel, this is where you run into trouble. And where I run into trouble, it's so obvious, is, when you enter a house, What do you do? When you enter a house in Japan, what do you do with your shoes? Do you, you take them off, you leave them on, what do you do? Well, in an Arab country, if you're sitting there and you cross your legs and show the sole of your shoe to somebody, I mean, that's an offense. I mean, he might pull out a, gun and kill you because you just really offended him. I lived in Brazil for 23 years, and there are all kinds of things that you pick up when you walk into a house. You greet everybody in the house. You go around and you either hug them or you kiss them or whatever. All around everybody in the house. Well, then when you leave, you do the same thing. So it takes a lot of time to come and to go. And then there are other, how's everything going? Somebody says this and you go, ooh, that's the bird in Portuguese. And so, there's things you have to watch. And if you don't do it right, then you don't belong. And when you figure out what the behavior is to fit with these belief systems, then you have a sense of place and it makes you a member. Now, what's happened to us here is relativism says there really isn't anything to believe. There is no meta story. And so, whatever you believe, that's okay. And so, if there's nothing really to believe, then there is nothing to dictate what our behavior should be. Because my behavior is going to reflect my belief, and so my behavior is going to be all over the chart. Privatization says, okay, if you believe something, keep it to yourself. And so I may have a behavior in my home that would be consistent with my belief. But I can't take that into the public society. And so, because privatization says keep it to yourself. And so what happens is you lose your sense of place within your own society because there is no strong common set of common bonds between those two. Pluralism says, whatever you do, there are all kinds of things you can do. And it's really your business and nobody else's. And so, whatever it is you do, that's right for you, go ahead and do it. And so, once again, what you've got is a rupture between belonging and belief. Because, what you do is going to reflect belief. And as long as there is no common agreement as to what belonging consists of, then what you've really got is the fragmentation of a society. Now, the problem with this is that a society can't survive that way. We break down into little tribes. And what happens is when you live this way, you can't hold a marriage together. You can't hold a family together. You can't hold yourself together. And the people that I am dealing with today, that I'm reaching out to with the gospel, they are coming into the gospel just absolutely damaged, battered, and beaten. Just this last week, in one Bible study group that we've got, a grandson of one of the couples is 14 years old, and he is into very hard drugs and is suicidal, and they just had to institutionalize him. His cousin committed suicide, or his uncle committed suicide a year and a half ago, and so that's a part of the family thing. And, there are multiple marriages on both sides and so on, and so you just look at the mess, at the wreckage in human life, as a result of this storm that we have been talking about, as a result of this storm, and we realize that we've got our work cut out for us. I need to go back to this thing. And I just want to read a passage of scripture which you've got there in your notes. But I think this is very much the message for us today. The Spirit of the Sovereign Lord is on me, because the Lord has anointed me to preach good news to the poor. This is, by the way, Jesus' job description written by Isaiah about 700 years before Jesus got there. And he says, go back. He sent me to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim freedom for the captives, and release from darkness for the prisoners, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor and the day of vengeance of our God, to comfort all who mourn. And just about everybody I know mourns. Provide for those who grieve in Zion, to bestow on them a crown of beauty instead of ashes, the oil of gladness instead of mourning, and a garment of praise instead of a spirit of despair. They will be called oaks of righteousness, a planting of the Lord for the display of his splendor. Now, who's the they that will be called oaks of righteousness? It's those people that were all in pieces. Not the strong, but the weak. And those same weak people then, they will not only be able to stand for themselves, but they'll be shade trees for other people. And those same ex-weak people will rebuild the ancient ruins and restore the places long devastated. They will renew the ruined cities that have been devastated for generations. We've talked about 500 years of devastation. The thing that I think is so significant is that the job description that Christ came with, which he reiterated in Luke 4, 16 through 18, is to deal with precisely this problem that we have been discussing here this morning. It's not beyond repair. It's what Christ is all about. Now, here we live with this dichotomy. We believe these great truths, and then we deal with the hassles of everyday life, and we can't put them together. I think our theologians over the last couple of centuries have done a number on us. They haven't left us with a theology that allows us to do what has to be done to participate in Christ's work in the way that he wants us to participate in it. And that's really what this thing that we're doing here is all about. It's to understand how to bring convergence on what we believe and on everyday life. But it's going to require a tremendous mind shift in many areas. So that's it. Our time is up.